to my mind, fails to discriminate between those prayers which are ancient texts, authored, fixed, and sanctified by Chazal, with those which are much later introductions and purely optional. Thus, for example, in an attempt to demonstrate that Judaism permits innovative creativity, he cites the creation of prayers in honor of Jewish Shabbat, the private recitation of Tfilah Zakah on Erev Yom Kippur, and the introduction of Lachal Dodi. Based on these innovations, he asks if Jewish liturgy is indeed not crystallized, even accepts additions, why can't we add the matriarchs to the first bracha of the Amidah? This attempt at comparison, to my mind, is truly surprising. At Tu B'Shvat Seder, Tfilah Zakah and even Lachal Dodi are all optional prayers, not even formulated as benedictions, as brachot. Their authority, if anything, comes only from minhag, from the fact that Klal Yisrael has seen fit to recite them. How can one compare their introduction into the liturgy to the additions of the Imahot in the first brach of Shmona Esrei, whose text was fixed by Chazal, and where there's a serious issue of bracha levatala? I'm going to return in a moment to the issue of introducing the Imahot, but I'd like to focus on the issue of optional prayers. One of Rabbi Sperber's suggestions was to remove the phrase Vishtunu Ketumat Hanida from Tachanun. The tour cites Rav Naturnoigon to the effect that Tachanun is purely an optional prayer. It's only a proper custom to add some requests for mercy immediately after Shmona Esrei. Indeed, the exact text is not sanctified. In source number one before you, and I'm going to mention several sources, and I'll just digest because I simply don't have the time. In source number one before you, Rabbi Elezer Melamed writes that if one is in the middle of Tachanun, and the Chazan has started to say the Kaddish right after Tachanun, the congregant should skip to the end of the Tachanun and continue davening with the Tzibur, because the text of the Tachanun is not critical. She'ein nusach ha-tachanunim ma'akev, v'chol shitchanein ma'at, far yasa yidei chuvat ha-minhag. Hence, anyone who wants to follow Professor Sperber's suggestions of removing the phrase v'shitzuna ketumat ha-nida from Tachanun is certainly welcome to do so. Indeed, with optional prayers, I similarly see little problem with making any necessary changes or corrections. For instance, removing from Brishmei the phrase "V'tev li bnin dechin diadun vutech," may I be blessed with male progeny to your will. Now, some of you may not even know that it was there at one time because they've already taken it out. Good old Hasidic syndrome habit. Or, for instance, deleting the mention or the supplications to angels in Slichot or Hineni, or removing the reference to Babylonia in Yekum Purkam, the Sfardim don't even say it, or adding Haracham on Yevarech in Medinat Yisrael to the Arachamans after Ayechasreinu in Birkat HaMazon, or adding the Tina to the Shalom Tisha B'Av, or even adding the Imahot to the Mishaberach for an Oleh or the Choleh. These are optional prayers with no set text or benedictions sanctified by Chazal. A more fundamental problem with Rabbi Sperber's analysis has to do with the blurring of the differences between the Chatchila and the Diavad. And this is a failing we've already noted in his analysis in another wonderful book, Darkash al Halacha, which deals with Kvod HaTzibur regarding women's aliyot. The author repeatedly suggests that lechatchila means the preferred or ideal way of performance. And for me, I believe that he simply errs. Lechatchila means pre-facto and refers to the obligatory way one has to act under normative conditions. For example, Chazal say that one should not use a milchik spoon, she'enu ben yomo, that hasn't been used for 24 hours, to stir hot chicken soup. Similarly, Chazal say that one should not eat out of utensils that have not been immersed in a mikvah, shalom nidpalu. In both cases, b'diavad, post facto, the food is perfectly kosher. Nevertheless, Chazal's ruling in both these cases of a milk spoon or kelim shalom nidpalu is not a recommendation, but rather a clear directive. This is what you have to do under normative conditions. It's forbidden to act otherwise. This is also true regarding obligatory prayer texts and benedictions. Chazal forbade changes lechatchila, even though b'dievet or b'shat hadchak, the change is valid. Thus, Maimonides writes in source number 2, and I'll read it in English, the wording of all the blessings, Ezra and his court enacted them, and it is inappropriate to change them, nor to add to one of them, nor to detract from one of them, and anyone who changes the wording coined by the sages in the blessings is simply erring. And Professor Spur himself cites the case of Mishnah on this Rambam, explains that if one erred and changed the text of a bracha, what he recited was improper and inappropriate, but then the benediction, b'diavad, post facto, is valid. This is provided, as we said, that the overall content and structure of the bracha remains intact. But the fact that an improper benediction is b'diavad valid is in no way a carte blanche to change the prayer text at will. Contrary to Professor Sperber's intimation, if the change was made in the bracha, it needs to be corrected and should not be repeated again. Indeed, Rav Yosef Kara rules, and I look now at source 3, that if instead of making hamotzi, this I'm sure is the law that you all know, if instead of making hamotzi, you said instead shahako, or you said the bracha in Aramaic, the halacha is that the bracha is valid. But the Gra and the Mishnah Berurah say that it's only b'dievet, that it's usher to do make a shahaku, lechatila. Because Chazal said not to. Chazal said this is the bracha to say. It is clear that the major differences in the obligatory prayer texts of the various Edot occurred prior to the printing press, where the text was learned by rote, and hence subject to accumulation of errors over time. These changes were of a b'diavad status and should have been corrected immediately. But after time, no one knew what the proper text was. Similarly, changes introduced for fear or by the censor also have a sha'at hadchak status, which in halakha is equivalent to diavad kol sha'at hadchak ki diavad dami. Censored changes often remain in place for hundreds of years. Take, for example, the changes in Aleinu Shemesh Ta'avim Le'evavari. Hundreds of years before conditions improve and the origin of the change is uncovered and corrected. Many outstanding scholars over the centuries did their best to educate to their communities as to the correct nusach. Indeed, the tinkering with the text by the Hasidic Ashkenaz, the Arizal students, the Hasidic masters, and other scholars through the generation is beautifully documented by Professor Sperber. Well, all attempts to correct the text and to return it to what they thought was the authentic version. The authentic version instituted by Chazal. But nowhere do we find examples where under normative conditions, leading scholars consciously corrupted what they knew to be a perfectly good text so as to correspond to some passing fancy or ideology. Let's now discuss Professor Sperber's third mode of analysis with which we take issue. As Professor Sperber correctly notes in source number 4, he actually quotes a Gemara in Pirkei Avot, and I think this Gemara is better. In Brachot Chaftef Amid Beis, this Gemara tells us that one is obligated to be Mechadesh Dabar, to add something new, to be some personal new element to your daily Shmon Esrei. Now the rules for adding novel requests into the Shmon Esrei are explicitly discussed in Shulchan Aruch. Professor Sperber does not make note of the fact that there is a clear distinction between the 13 middle brachot, or the bakashot in the middle of Shmon Esrei, and the opening and closing, 3 on each side, the opening and closing 6. Indeed, in the middle benedictions, one is allowed, even encouraged, to add preferably towards the end of the bracha. However, in the first and last 3 brachot, no additions are permitted whatsoever. This is indeed part of the reason why, if you look through scans of Professor Sperber's masterful book, you'll find extensive changes in the middle brachot, and he goes to great lengths to document it, and almost no change, not that no changes at all, but almost no changes in the first and the last brachot. It also explains why the poskim were more forthcoming when it came to slight changes in the Birkat Nachem recited on Tisha B'Av, which is one of the middle brachot. There are 2 categories of exceptions to this rule about no changes in the opening and closing brachot. And by the way, the battle over the permissibility of these 2 exceptions was an extensive one and merely affirms the premise that I'm telling you, that under normative conditions you can't make changes. It's like the exceptions prove the rule. The first class of exceptions are the 4 verses introduced during the Aseret Yemei Tshuva, Zochrin L'chaim, Michal Mocha Avrachim, Uchtov, and the Sefer Chaim. These were accepted primarily for 3 reasons. Firstly, because the custom to recite them dates back at least to the Gaonic period. The Ramban documents it back to Masechet Sofrim, and perhaps even to the end of the Amoraic period. Second, because they are temporary rather than permanent changes. And finally, because they are communal requests, requests for life, which has an element of Shatat Chak to it. The other exception relates to the insertion of Piyutim, which we already noted was vigorously resisted by all the leading poskim. But what can you do? What can you do? The meaning of the people was to say it. And even those who accepted their recitation did so only because the Piyutim were written by outstanding scholars going back 700 to 1500 years ago. In addition, there was a clear proviso that the Piyutim only be said b'tzibur, not in your private Shmon Esrei. Indeed, in a very large number of shuls in Israel, there are only a selected number of piyutim which are recited, and only in the Shmon Esrei, Chazaret HaShatz. I'd like to analyze now Rabbi Sperber's specific suggestion of adding the Imahot into the opening paragraph of the Amidah. This is a practice that has found its way into conservative Jewish practice and the conservative prayer books. Despite the objection of many of their own leading scholars, like David Golikin. Indeed, this proposal can be rejected on many halachic grounds. Firstly, as just discussed, no changes or additions whatsoever should be allowed in the first 3 brachot of the Shmon Esrei, most certainly not if they're permanent, and most certainly not if they're in the private Shmon Esrei. Furthermore, we have to ask whether this change is in line with the content and the intent of the bracha as established by Chazal. After all, why are the Avot in the Shmon Esrei? Why does the Shmon Esrei begin? Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech HaOlam. Why is that Elokeinu Melech HaOlam? And you look at source number 6, 5, the Chazal, the Mechilta tells us that it's based on a pasuk. The wording comes straight from a pasuk stated at the burning bush. Uminayim shomrim Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech HaOlam Elokei Abraham Elokei Yitzchak Elokei Yaakov Shema. Vayomer Od Elokim El Moshe. This is from the burning bush. Kol Tomar Bnei Yisrael Hashem Elokei Avotechem Elokei Abraham Elokei Yitzchak Elokei Yaakov. And in source 6, I give you passage just a few psukim later. You have the same language. Leman Yaminu Kinerei Lecha Hashem Elokei Avotechem Elokei Abraham Elokei Yitzchak Elokei Yaakov. Indeed, the rubric, the fathers Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob occurs numerous times throughout Tanakh in connection with God's revelation and its covenantal pronouncements. That's why it's in Shmoneh Esrei. On the other hand, nowhere in Tanakh do you have the rubric of the four Imahot. Nowhere do we see Sarif the Rechavalei in Tanakh. It appears the first time in rabbinic literature. Hence, to include the Imahot as a group into the opening verses of the Shmoneh Esrei would be a misrepresentation of Jewish theology. As we see from source 7, our covenantal relationship to God comes through the Avot, not the Imahot. V'zachati et b'riti Yaakov, v'at et b'riti Yitzchak, v'at et b'riti Avraham esko, v'aret esko. The Imahot, to be sure, were very important supporting players. But they were not the leads. Those are the facts. To introduce the Imahot into the opening bracha would be a misrepresentation for another reason. Our model for approaching the Creator in prayer is based on the patriarchs, the Avot, who Chazal taught us were the ones who established the three tefillot. Avram, source number 8, Avram tikein tefillat shacharit, Yitzchak tikein tefillat mincha, Yaakov tikein tefillat arvit. In addition, the survey of Tanakh makes it clear that one of the major functions of the prophet was to pray for individuals. This, you can look through all of Tanakh. I just brought one case that came to mind in source number 9. God says to Abimelech, Vata hashev eshati, ish give back his wife, and he'll pray, ki naviu, The adjectives used in the opening of Shmoneh Esrei, Hakel Agadol, Hagibol, is language of the prophets. The Avot were all bona fide prophets. They were major prophets, as the text itself tells us. But the Gemara Megillah, in source number 10, does not list the Imahot, except for Sarah, it does mention Sarah, as the Imahot's prophets. Now, there is a Medrash Rabbah, and Rashi quotes this Medrash Rabbah, the Imahot were prophets, but they're not mentioned amongst the 55 prophets that are mentioned in Gemara Megillah, and that tells us that they weren't major prophetesses, if they were prophetesses at all. And besides, why mention the Imahot? We don't mention Moshe Rabbeinu, who gave us the Torah. We don't mention David HaMelech, who wrote Tehillim, on which most of prayer is based. Why mention the Imahot? Just because they were women? Just because of feminist sensibilities? This is not only theological misrepresentation, it's intellectually dishonest. I don't think that women should be excluded where relevant just because of their gender. But for the same reason, they shouldn't be included where irrelevant, just because of their gender. I'd like to turn now to the other issue raised by Rabbi Sperber, and this is the question of the recitation of Shalom Asani Isha benediction in Birkot HaShachar, along with Shalom Asani Goy and Shalom Asani Abed. Professor records that many women find the negative formulation, who has not made me a woman, derogatory. In fact, I panned my own family, God blessed me with three daughters and a, th- three daughters and a daughter-in-law and a wife. And in fact, my wife says that I was blessed with three daughters. God said, you're such a feminist. Put up or shut up. And they all felt that the bracha was clearly problematic. In light of the flexibility Professor Sperber sees in Jewish liturgy, he argues for the permissibility of modifying this benediction, Shelo Asani Isha, to Shasani Ish, or Shasani Yisrael, and Shasani Kitzono to Shasani Isha, or Shasani Yisraeli. I would like to make it clear that there is no doubt about the authenticity of this bracha. This is a bona fide bracha established by Chazal, because it's mentioned three times in rabbinic literature, in the Tosefta, the Talmud Bavli, and the Rishami, and there are no shinui nischalot on it. Both the Tosefta and the Rishami make it clear that the benediction is related strictly to men's greater obligation in mitzvot. As you all know, women are free from mitzvot asei, shazman gamah, time determined, positive commandments, which include inter alia sukkah, lulav, shofar, tefillin, and tzitzis. Based on what we discussed above, it is clearly forbidden to remove or modify an obligatory bracha. Reams have been written to explain the import of these benedictions and why they are in the negative. And I certainly don't have the time to review the explanations. But I would like, however, to bring to your attention the comments of Rav Reuven Margoliot in the Marshan. This is sources 12 and 13. And you can read them at your leisure. Let me just tell you what they say. These scholars note that the one who has a greater obligation has potential for greater reward, but also for greater punishment. Should he or she not do as required? Let's take an example of a man who doesn't put on tefillin or doesn't sit in the sukkah. It's not just that he didn't do an essay. He gets punished for bitul essay, for not fulfilling a positive commandment. Hence, each of us is required to acknowledge that the Creator could have made me other. He could have made me a non-Jew or a slave or a woman with fewer obligations, but also with fewer risks. Yet the Almighty chose not to. By reciting the identity bracha, Shelo Asani Goy, Shelo Asani Ovid, Shelo Asani Isha, each of us accepts upon ourselves, mutatis mutandi, the spiritual role that we have been given. The Shelo is not, it should be translated as a sober acceptance, a sober acknowledgement. Who has not? Not a rejoicing, yippee, because he has not. As far as the negative problem, Rabbi Nissen Alpert Zal suggests a lovely rationale as to why these brachot are formulated in the negative. It's because Chazal wanted to communicate it to us that HaKadosh Baruch Hu only gives us the opportunity. He defines who we are not. It is up to us to define who we are, to fill the positive and maximize our potential. And interestingly, this very idea appears in the writings of the 19th century Reb Tzedek HaKohen, which is in source 14, which you're welcome to read. Now, Rabbi Sperber has waved off all explanations of this sort as apologetic. I guess one man's apologetics is another man's honest explanation. I'm happy with these explanations. They sit well with me. To my mind, why misunderstand the bracha, cast aspersions on Chazal, and create a problem? Far better to understand it properly, which I believe is the Emes interpretation, so no problem exists. The truth, however, ladies and gentlemen, is that there is much more at stake in this benediction than just its negative formulation. You see, all Jews share the same level of Kedushat Israel, the same level of Jewish sanctity. But Jewish law distinguishes between the obligations of Kohanim, Levim, and Yisraelim, as well as between males and females. But this lack of identity and that lack of in the difference in chiyuv and mitzvahs tells us that our religious obligations are different and leads to the inescapable conclusion that Judaism is most definitely not egalitarian. Upo kavur hakelef, or as Shakespeare would say, aye, there's the rub. Women's exemption from mitzvot aseishas mangrama, about which there is no dispute, is derived in the oral law through the use of the hermeneutical principles, the Klalei Hedvash. Rambam posits that this exemption is rooted in the ancient oral tradition. In either case, the exemption is deemed to be biblical in origin. The bottom line, then, is that Halachic Judaism maintains that God himself ordained and commanded non-identical roles for men and women. God ordained that Judaism is not egalitarian. This clearly does not sit well with feminists. Indeed, Judith Plaskow believes that this is, I quote, a profound injustice of the Torah itself in discriminating between men and women. For those whose highest commitment is to halacha, the lack of identity in religious roles is a resounding rejection of certain basic feminist values. It suggests that the Torah's set of priorities is not always consonant with that of modern-day radical feminism. All this comes loud and clear through the bracha Shelo Asani Isha, and is the fundamental reason why feminists have battled for a more egalitarian language, like Shasani Yisrael or Shiasani Yisraelit. The latter communicates nothing about the different levels of mitzvah obligations of men and women, which is the whole purpose of the content and the intent of this bracha, as we're told by the Tosefta in Yerushalmi. Doing as Professor Sperber proposes is, to my mind, not only halachically wrong, but it's theologically incorrect and misleading. In summary, then, I found Professor Sperber's historical survey of the evolution of Jewish liturgy truly enjoyable, definitely edifying and breathtaking by the book, and I found it breathtaking in its depth and its breadth. I have, however, found it seriously lacking in its halachic analysis, and in the most unconvincing, to my mind, attempt to direct and effect change in Jewish liturgy in the future. Perhaps we should recall the words of Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, who wrote in 1954, "The crisis of prayer is not a problem of the text. It is a problem of the soul. The sitter must not be used as a scapegoat. A revision of the prayer book will not solve this problem." Thank you.